I can do, yeah. I really vividly, actually, 1972 it was. And that's how old I was, 60 yesterday, actually. So that's
Oh, happy
old I am.
birthday.
Yeah, it's significant, I believe it's called. Yeah, so I just felt old yesterday, but I feel young today, so we're all right. Yeah, 1972, and Liverpool won 2-0. And the only reason I remembered seeing one of the goals was that they scored a penalty in front of the cop, because I was just transfixed by the cop. And I'd been to, like, a lot of reserve games with my dad, and it was like every time you went up, there was a couple of hundred, maybe a couple of thousand or two in the stand, and you know, there was no one there. But on this day, we went up on the bus and it was really busy. And I said to my dad, I said, "Oh, it's really busy today." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, they must all be going to Quick Save, you know, which is the supermarket." And I went, "Oh, the Quick Save's going to be busy." And I got to the car park outside the old main stand, and I've never seen it so full. And I was just 6 at the time, so you know, nearly 7 I was. So, like, for me, it, you know, the men were giants, and I got on the ground, and as you walked up into the ground, you see the green pitch first, don't you? And then, but the stands were full of people, and he'd never been full before, you know, and it was amazing. And as I said, I was just transfixed by the cop from that moment onwards. And I say, if they hadn't scored the penalty, I wouldn't have seen a goal.
So for anyone, Keith, who might not know what the cop is and why it's so special, just explain that to us.
It was the legendary standing area behind the goal at Anfield, and it was where the most passionate fans tended to stand. It was a cheaper area of the ground. And it was legendary from the 60s, from, you know, singing Beatles songs. And it was a real sort of powerful experience to actually stand on the cop. But as a youngster, it was a man's terrain at the time. It was sort of like you had to be grown up. There wasn't as much crowd safety in those days. So the swaying of the cop, you know, you had to really be able to hold your own on those terraces. But that's where the most passionate people were. That's where the song came from. That's where the atmosphere. And they were the people who were always credited with sucking a ball into the net and getting Liverpool across the line. So, you know, the story's a legend. And I say, my dad was a copite, and I grew up on stories of the cop, and Bill Shankly was still there when I first went to the game, and he was the hero of my dad. And then, you know, Kevin Keegan was playing for us, and I met Kevin Keegan a few weeks ago over here in the Isle of Man, and he was amazing, absolutely wonderful fella, and really nice, down to earth, humble. He was my first hero, and I told him that, and he'd already knew about me. He'd done his research because he knew I was going to be in the room. And he mentioned me in his presentation, which is like the biggest honour of my life. I was made up. And so I said to him, "Oh, you're my first hero." And then he said, "Yeah, but then Kenny came along, didn't he? And I'm just no one's hero anymore." And you can't argue with that.
It's so cool, Keith, hearing the passion and the lightness in your voice when you talk about all of this. Because I think partly I wanted to speak to you on this subject because there are some people out there that, you know, football is not part of their lives. They don't experience this. They don't have this ritual every single Saturday or every single weekend.
Yeah.
Why is it so special for you?
It's been my life, you know, and I remember doing a radio. This is my second book. I wrote a book in 2009, and it was based after we went to Istanbul, after Liverpool won the Champions League in Istanbul, and I had this amazing journey to get there and back. And some people go, "You know, isn't that a bit sad that your life revolves around it?" I said, "My life doesn't revolve around it. It's the thing I'm really most passionate about. But, like, it comes second to family. It comes second to my children and my wife." And I've got to say that because you're going to listen to this. I once made the mistake of saying Istanbul was the greatest night of my life. And I don't make that mistake anymore. It was...
Second greatest.
No, one of the greatest nights. obviously, my wedding night's the greatest night of my life.
Ah, of course.
I'm reminded, yeah. Not the night the kids were born, the night the wedding was. But yeah, it was like, this is what I've done forever. My passion, that was everything I wanted to do. I wanted to follow my dad. And, you know, I grew up on stories of him going to Bruges and going to Rome to watch Liverpool win the league. And all I was interested in was that. And when I'd become 16 and started to leave school, I could then follow him on my own. And, you know, I'd go on the football specials in them days. And when I first started working, all my money was spent following Liverpool. So I'd go away and watch them all the time. And in the 80s, between 85 and 90, I didn't miss a game home or away.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, but that was my life. That's what I did. And it's funny because I'm there looking at Twitter over the last few days, jealous of all these guys who've gone out to Japan and Hong Kong to watch Liverpool. And they're going, I wish I could do it, but you can't do everything. I've been really lucky. But I still got that passion, and now that passion's gone to my son, you see. So I got off my dad, and now my son gets it off me, and he's more passionate than me now because I'm old, you know. That's
hard to believe, Keith, talking to you now.
I'm not the most passionate fan you'll meet. When you go abroad to meet Liverpool fans abroad, the passion is unbelievable because their dream is to do what I've done. And I think this is why the book resonates, is you've got two groups of people sort of thing. You've got people who've done what I've done. We've been fortunate to do it. And then people whose dream is to come to Anfield or dream is to follow them in Europe. But I've been able to live that dream. And I'd probably be retired by about 10 years if I hadn't spent all that money following Jürgen Klopp and his buddies. But yeah, it's just like, and it's not about the football. I think you said it a few minutes ago, Katie, where people might not get this, but it's not about that 90 minutes on the grass. And I think FIFA and UEFA and the FA, they all miss the point. It's about camaraderie. It's about love and friendship. And it's about being, you know, in a space with people who have a like for the same thing as you do. And, you know, we get to share the joy. We get to share the disappointment. We've got to share the tragedies, unfortunately. But, you know, it makes us stronger people for it. And, you know, one of the things that it is, it's like probably, I think Jürgen Klopp said it's the most important of the least important things in your life. And I think that's true for me personally. But if you didn't like football, you could like rugby or you could be part of the Barmy Army. You know, I think the Lions are down in Australia now. And I was lucky to work in South Africa for a period of time where I'd go down for a week at a time every year. And I followed a Lions tour one year. And every plane I was on, the Lions fans were on. And they were just doing the same sort of thing I'd done following Liverpool. It's just they were following the British Lions. It was amazing, you know. So it's that passion and love and belief. And when Liverpool won the league against Tottenham, the day they actually won the league, I was fortunate to be in my season ticket seat, which is in the middle of the cop. And the guys have sat around. I've sat around them for most of them nearly 30 years. All that time where Liverpool hadn't won the league, except where we couldn't be in the ground to celebrate. So the amount of love on that day was absolutely unbelievable. You know, you got to share it. I'm nearly crying talking about it now because actually they're just special moments. And
it's about sharing them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I wonder how special it is sharing it with your son as well.
Well, if I could just talk about the sharing element of it, because there was two games at the end of the season. One was the Tottenham game where they actually physically win the league. And then the last game was the Crystal Palace game where they lift the trophy. So Charlie was in my season ticket seat for lifting the trophy. So he's with all my friends and he's sharing the love with all them. And I'm row 89 of the main stand as far away from possible with a different group of people and not sharing that love of my wider circle sort of thing, you know what I mean? And, you know, so he had the amazing day that I'd had against Tottenham. So I had an amazing night afterwards when we all met up. And now he's 18. He could come to town with us and he had a great time. And, yeah, you know, sharing it for him, he'd never seen that. So, you know, it was really special. But the way modern football works is we're often not sitting together. So I'm begging for a ticket elsewhere in the ground and he's there. So, you know, we got to share the Carabao Cup when they won the other year. And we got to share that trophy and that was probably the most beautiful moment with him because other times we're split up So he's sharing it with my brother or my friends, and I'm Billy No Mates on my own.
And the thing with football, Keith, you've mentioned it already, it's about highs and it is about lows as well. Liverpool have had plenty of lows throughout the history of the club, none more so than the disaster at Hillsborough, but more recently as well, the tragic death of Diogo Jota, the Liverpool player. What's it like having to share those moments, those harder moments?
They're really quite difficult, actually. If I just start with Diogo, outside of my dad passing away and Hillsborough and the related issues with Hillsborough, that's probably the saddest day of my life, you know, because actually he had everything. And it's funny, some people might go, well, he's just a footballer, but the way social media works now and the way you feel like you know these guys, you feel like they represent you and the joy. And he's just being married to his childhood sweetheart. He's got the kids, everything. Life doesn't work like that. Sometimes it hits you with those disappointments. And I went up to Anfield when I was last home, and I did, and I had a look around, and just go, it was such a sad sight, but it was a beautiful sight. But that sight took me back to 1989 with the carpet of flowers at Anfield. And, you know, Hillsborough never goes away for us, but it's a different thing now, because in the book, the chapter about Hillsborough is post-Hillsborough. It's about the fight for justice and the truth. And it was the most angry thing I've ever written, because I am angry about it, because actually, you know, the fight for justice goes on, and the lies and the deceit is there for everyone to see. And it's not just Hillsborough now. The Hillsborough law that they're trying to get through Parliament that keeps getting blocked protects people like the Grenfell families and the post office, you know, people who are like the infected blood scandals. It infects normal people, you know, and it needs to come through. I don't know what people are scared of. Well, I do know what people are scared of, but we live in a country where you are forced by law to tell the truth. That's not a place to be. You know, why can't you just tell the truth? So I wrote about Hillsborough in 2009 in my first book. And that day, that was about going on the day and how it felt and what it was like. And it was the truth. And it took the longest inquest in British history for everyone to go, oh, that was the truth. Yeah, but we've been telling you since 1989. I think if you had smartphones in 1989, you wouldn't be where you are now. And then when we went to Paris the other year, which is once again in the book and Charlie's with me, there was a lot of similarities with that. It was a very dangerous situation. And I think because of the way the fans behaved meant it didn't get as bad as it could have done, because there were so many similarities with it. And he was scared for me about how I'd respond and how I'd react, because the triggers, they are triggers. But I was lucky. I'd just had counselling probably a year before. Some really good, like... it was like CBT type therapy that dealt with my issues from Hillsborough. So I was actually okay, really. But I know it triggered a lot of people. And, you know, because they were dangerous positions to be in. But once again, it was authorities treating people the wrong way. And the book has that, and life has that. You've got to go. It's the community you get through. If we didn't look after each other, so... If experienced people like me weren't telling people to calm down and not to provoke the police, who didn't need any provocation anyway, and the reaction was, if we didn't say calm down, when you go to Europe, it's a different thing. You know, you're not speaking in your first language. The sticks come out before, you know, anyone has any dialogue with anybody. So if you don't use your experience, it could be in 10 times worse. It could be in really, really bad.
Thanks for being able to share that with us as well, Keith, because like you say, you know, it's triggering those memories. And I think sometimes it can be easy for those of us who've not lived through things like that to talk about it as though there aren't still people that have those memories.
Yeah. And it's really important to talk about it. Now, we talk about men's mental health, and, you know, I'm a big advocate. And I thought when I was putting the book together, I thought I've got to talk about this, because we are in a world now where you need to talk about it, because there's still men taking their lives, not talking to people. So you've got to go, it's okay to to talk about it, because vulnerabilities are often transient and temporary. So actually, you'll come through it. You know, you will, but you've got to talk to people. And there's a thing with Hillsborough where people go, they won't understand because they weren't there. And there is an element to that. If you weren't there, you're not going to fully understand it. But it doesn't mean you can't listen to someone. And when someone's talking to you, you don't need to have the answers for them. It's like lifting a weight off the shoulders. And in the book, Liverpool would just beat Barcelona 4-0. And it's the greatest night of your life and all of a sudden like that. And I just dropped through the floor. Biggest depression of my life. Why? I don't know. And I nearly never got off on the plane to go to Madrid. But my trip was actually sponsored by Imodium. So actually I did. So, but when I was on my trip, I spoke to my best friend at football for over 30 years. I spoke to my brother about it. And immediately you could feel this weight lift off you. And for the whole weekend, the issues that I'd been facing for the previous 2 weeks didn't exist. But that was the point where I knew I had to go and get proper help then. And I was lucky I worked for a bank who allowed me to do that.
Should we look ahead to the new season then, Keith? Because it's all about to kick off again and Liverpool go in as the reigning champions of the Premier League with the new manager in place. And they did it in one season and it's all a bit ridiculous. What's going to happen this season?
Well, we've opened John Henry's pocket, which is amazing. We've been promised this war chest for the last 3 or 4 years, and then they spent, I think, 15 million on Chiesa. But yeah, it's like he had a plan. He got through what he did last year, done amazing last year. And I think you're going to see a totally different team this year. They're going to attack a lot more, where it was quite cagey last year and you were methodical. I think you're going to see some really exciting stuff from them. It's got two brilliant new fullbacks. They've got like Florian Wirt, who looks amazing. They go, Ekatike, the new young kid up the front, he's like a box of tricks. And you've got Champions League, you've got Champions League winners, you've got Premier League winners, you've got people who know how to win stuff in your team. They secure Van Dijk and they secured Salah, and you just go, this is going to be more exciting. Like last year, we were trepidation. We didn't know what was going to happen and what was happened, but it was amazing. But this year, it's going to be off the scale, I think.
Who's going to run Liverpool the closest in the title race, do you think?
I'm not really sure, to be fair. I don't think City can be as bad as they were last year. Because they just fell off a cliff and they lost Rodri for a long time and he was a key man for them. I could see them being obviously the challenge again, really. Outside of that, you go Arsenal, maybe. It's like, how do they deal with coming so close and falling by the wayside?
Well, they've spent quite a lot of money as well, haven't they, in this transfer window?
Everyone seems to spend some money in the transfer window. And then you've got the likes of City and Chelsea went to America for the FIFA Club World Cup. What effect's that going to have come November and December? Are they going to start getting loads of fatigue injuries because they've had no time off over the summer? Where Liverpool have had a lot of time off, really. And, they had a lot of time off towards the end of the league campaign as well. Because they were, they won the league so early that they didn't have to, pull a tripe out every week, So, so it's going to be really interesting. But I think we're the ones to beat for a change. And every year we say we're going to win the league. Oh, we've always had that belief, even if we weren't. But, I think this season, why not just plow on? But you've also think, okay, made a lot of changes. How do they all bed in? And also, what's the effect on losing one of the best mates and losing them out of dressing room? I've worked in places where people have unfortunately not come in after the weekend, and it there's an odd dynamic in the room because there's an empty peg or there's an empty chair or whatever. Let's wait and see. It's going to be exciting again. And I'm over for the Bournemouth game, so I'll be there on the first day as well with Charlie by my side this time,
Even better, as it should be. Keith, thank you so much and enjoy the new season and best of luck.
Thanks, Katie. So nice to speak to you. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, that was absolutely, I had goosebumps through that talking to you. Firstly, through all the highs, and it's so relatable, I think, if you follow football, but then, all those the tough times you've been through as well. Thank you so much for sharing it all.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity, and like I've been able to do book launches and things like that, you know, lately. So it's nice when people listen and take it in. And you, normally when you talk about the mental health bit in Hillsborough now, you can hear a pin drop in the room.
Yeah.
Because most people have never heard the chat because they have a version of it that is sanitized within the media. And unfortunately, a lot of people believe that Sun headline from all them years ago. The damage that done was unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, and the media have a part to play in that. You know, so one of the big things about Paris was a lot of the media teams got caught up in the chaos.
Yeah.
And they could see what was going on. And the media was very supportive. Jordan Paris, I think Kavi Solokol of Sky Sports was right in the middle of it. And he was reporting, going, no, this, it wasn't the fans. And, you know, there's quite a few strong voices who were in the media going, listen, it's not what it is. Because literally within 10 minutes, UEFA were blaming us.
Yeah.
Late arrival of fans. We were there 3 hours before. And you know, so... How early do you want us to be there?
Don't open the doors before that, do they?
No, yeah. Anyway, did you have a good time over in Switzerland?
Oh, fantastic. Amazing. Just did you watch much of it?
I saw a fair bit of it actually.
Yeah.
And I was quite interested because he played the final in Basel, didn't he?
Yeah.
And we had really bad experience in Basel because we played Seville and we got beat 3-1.
Oh.
It's latched down and it was like horrendous and it was like the worst place for a final where we could have took 60,000 or 70,000. You know, we had 10,000 tickets or something like that, and it was just a mess from start to end.
Yeah.
And it was probably one of the poorer experiences. Whereas they could have gone the San Siro or something like that, you know.
I mean, it worked quite well for this tournament. I think they had purposely gone for smaller stadiums but packed them out, and actually. Yeah. I thought that made for a really good atmosphere.
It seemed to do that. One of the things that, you know, was really noticeable was in the heat as well. It was hot, wasn't it? Switzerland in summer's not cold, yeah.
No, oh my word, so muggy and humid. But yeah, I mean, they just absolutely nailed it in terms of like, if you want an advert for the game and if people are new to women's football and they want to see how it's come on, like, just look how hard fought all of those games were. None of, you know, even if England should have won them, they didn't win easily. And
how many went to penalties? Yeah. Well, you know, like, semi-finals were proper semi-finals, weren't there? Was a lot of jeopardy in the room, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, Spain look like the men's team in Spain, where they play loads of pretty football but never get across the line. Do you know that?
100%. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think I try to represent football fans properly as well. You know, where you go. I think when I wrote my first book, all the books that you could read were about hooliganism. And mine wasn't. Mine's not got a fight. I've never had a fight. You know, it's just, it's about that passion. And that's the vast majority of people who follow the sport have the same experience, you know. And I think especially from here, we're from the Isle of Man, everything I do is like, it's like planes, trains and automobiles. You've got to take like Istanbul took 6 days to get there and back with like 5 planes and 4 trains. Why wouldn't you write a book about it?